Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, scientists say we still have time to address climate change, and we've made headway, but we still have a long way to go. We speak with renowned climate scientist Michael Mann. But first, sanitation and antibiotics have saved the lives of many, but are they also culprits behind some of our modern diseases? Our next guest argues that we may have gone overboard in killing our microbes, and that may be causing some of today's epidemics. Martin Blaser is a professor of translational medicine and director of the Human Microbiome Program at New York University. His new book is called Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Welcome, Martin Blaser. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle.
I'm really happy to be here.
Your primary argument in Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues is really that a lot of our illnesses today are really resulting from killing off a lot of these microbes that help our health in many ways. I thought where we should start is what these microorganisms are themselves. You describe them almost like ecosystems.
Most of the cells in the human body are, in fact, microbial cells. That is bacteria and, to a lesser extent, fungi and protozoa. Where the bacterial cells outnumber our human cells at least 3-1 and maybe 10-1. So we're mostly bacteria. If you took all the bacteria together and put them on a scale, they'd weigh about 3 or 4 pounds, about the same weight as our brain. And what we know is that these bacteria essentially are ancient, that we got them from our mom, and she got them from her mom, and so on and so forth, all the way back in time. Not only from our mom, but that's a very important source. These bacteria do many good things for us. They help train our immune system. They help us digest food. They make vitamins for us. They help keep out invaders. So these are very useful. We could call them the good guys.
You've said in the book that really this ecology of microbes, you call it the microbiome, are really key to our immune system. What examples can you give us?
We've been doing a lot of studies in mice, and others have done studies in mice. And it's clear that the distribution of these microbes, let's say we and others in the field are doing a lot of work, we're taking a census. We're saying, okay, which microbes are present in my body and in your body? And what about my intestine versus my skin? How are they similar? How are they different? And I can tell you that if we compared my skin and your skin, our skin is closer to each other than my skin is to my mouth, for example, because each niche has its own population, as you said, its own ecosystem.
Is there some comparison we can make to the non-microbe world that can help us to understand these unique ecosystems that each of us has?
Maybe we should start by saying, what is an ecosystem? And that's a collection of species, more or less all living together. We see that in ponds and lakes, in forests, on prairies. We see all different kinds of species. On the prairies, we see different kinds of grasses and different animals and worms and fungi. They're all living together. They've been living together in general for stable ecosystems for a very long period of time. And they really pretty much define the life that is present. And they're kind of hard to budge, so that when an invader comes in, they have a hard time getting a foothold, because the local species keep them out. And, of course, we think that's true within the human body as well, that the populations of different kinds of species in our skin, on our gut, in our mouth, very complex groups of organisms, they're functioning to do their work. They're all trying to eat and have babies and baby microbes. In doing this, they have functions that are beneficial to us, and that's why we're so interested in them.
Let's talk about what is happening, the antibiotic use, because this is really the thrust of your book. You're essentially saying that most of these modern plagues, especially things like obesity, are connected directly to the abundance of antibiotics and also when they're introduced to people.
First, let's start with some facts, and that is that since World War II, a number of diseases have become much more common than they were before. And that's what we could call our modern epidemics or our modern plagues. And these include such things as asthma and skin allergies, eczema, food allergies, wheat allergy, includes obesity and diabetes, even autism, inflammatory bowel disease. So imagine that you had 10 diseases that are all arising more or less in parallel. Either they have 10 different causes that all happened at the same time, or there's one thing that is underlying everything. And that's my theory, which I discuss in Missing Microbes, is that there is one thing underlying it, and that is a change in our ancient microbiome, our ancient ecosystem that we've had since time immemorial, as an unintended consequence of all the medical advances that we have, including especially antibiotics.
And let's break down some of the numbers. You talked about how much more obesity there is just in the past decade, not only in the U.S., but you noticed it in places like Chichen Itza.
Obesity is rising all over the world, especially in developed countries like the United States and Europe, but it's beginning to be present in China. It's beginning to be present in India. Even in Africa, obesity may be a bigger problem than malnutrition is. In the last decades, this has just come up worldwide. So something very important must be going on that is shared. Now, there's a lot of interest, of course, in food and calories and taking in too many calories. But diet alone hasn't been sufficient for us to understand what's going on in obesity. Diet is important, but it's not enough. And again, my hypothesis is that changes in our microbiome, these cells that are doing work for us, are important. And I want to introduce another concept, and that is we can think about the organisms in us at different stages of life. And to me, the most important organisms are the ones that are present early in life when we're really young kids, or our kids are really young, or our grandkids. We know now that these organisms are part of the development of our systems, of our processes in the body, metabolism, immunity, maybe even cognition. So if you perturb them early in life, you may change the course of development toward an individual who is pretty much destined to gain a lot of weight, for example.
How is this happening? One, you mentioned, is the antibiotics introduced at a very young age because it kills a lot of these microbes or it disturbs the balance. But the other you talk about is this increasing use of cesareans. How can that be related?
So we humans are mammals, and one of the characteristics of mammals is that they produce live birth, and the baby goes through a birth canal. So we don't lay eggs like birds do. And in the course of passing from the womb through the birth canal, a baby is picking up all these microbes from their mom. Part of the heredity of being a mammal is that you pick up your mom's microbes on your way out. And then you continue to pick up mom's microbes through contact with skin and mouth. But when a baby is born by cesarean section, they're missing this early contact. They're missing their introduction with the organisms that in other kids become the foundation for all the microbes in their body.
The connection with things like diabetes, celiac disease, how are these all related?
Well, there have been epidemiologic studies in which groups of moms and babies have been studied, large groups of hundreds or thousands of people, showing that babies born by C-section were more likely to have some of the markers of obesity or celiac disease or juvenile diabetes. So it's not that this is a theoretical risk. There's already evidence suggesting that there may be a cost to C-section that nobody was appreciating. Not a cost a day after birth or a week after birth, but a cost that's manifesting 10 years after birth, 20 years after birth. And there are precedents for this. And I want to come back to one of the earlier points, because for me, one day a light bulb went off. And that was, I knew for a long time that farmers feed antibiotics to their farm animals so that they'll gain weight. This is very widely done. It's where most of the antibiotics in the United States are going, on the farm, not to people. They're going to farm animals for the express purpose of promoting growth. And the reason they do this and they use so much antibiotics is because it works. They found that if they give antibiotics to young animals, they'll gain weight faster. Their feed efficiency improves. That's the ability to change food calories into body mass. And one day for me, about 10 years ago, a light bulb went off, and I thought, well, farmers are doing that, feeding antibiotics to increase the growth of their livestock. What are we doing to our children? Is it possible that the antibiotics we're giving our young kids for their throat infections, their ear infections, is having an unintended consequence, and that is that it's fattening them up. And that's what we've been working on for the last 10 years, and I talk about some of this work in Missing Microbes.
In terms of the unintended consequences, there are also others. We've got antibiotics in our water, in our soil, in our food. We're also seeing resistant bacteria.
Anytime antibiotics are used, it selects for resistance. Antibiotics will kill the susceptible bacteria, and the ones that are resistant will remain, and they'll take over the spot where the susceptible ones were. This is what Charles Darwin called natural selection. He didn't even recognize this with microbes, but ultimately, Darwin was right. If you don't believe in Darwin's concepts of evolution, all you have to do is study bacteria and the development of antibiotic resistance, and you see it very clearly.
What's the consequence of some of these resistant bacteria?
Consequences, unfortunately, are very serious. Before we had antibiotics, people would die from pneumonia. They would die from meningitis. They might die of blood poisoning from a splinter or something like that. There were many fatal infections. Now, with antibiotics, most of those infections are treatable. Most of them are curable. Also, in order to do cancer chemotherapy, to do transplantation, to do major surgery, we needed an umbrella of antibiotics around so that if somebody gets sick, we can treat them. I'm a doctor. If we have somebody who's getting chemotherapy, infection is a very major problem. So we can treat them with antibiotics. It would be a shame to suppress somebody's tumor, but then they die of an infection. So in order to have modern medicine, we need antibiotics. And if the antibiotics stop working because our bacteria have become resistant to them, then we could move back to an era when we can't do these surgeries. It's not just the cases of pneumonia, but it's the very ability to do things that we now take for granted, surgery, hip replacements. You know, if you didn't have antibiotics, you couldn't really do hip replacements because infections occur and they could be lethal.
And given that the antibiotics are so prevalent now in food, in water, in the soil, and is there any avoiding it?
Well, that's a very good question. There have been surveys that showed that because of the tremendous use of antibiotics on the farm, when you go to the supermarket, your meat may be contaminated by antibiotics. According to the regulations, it's not supposed to happen. But surveys have shown that it does happen. Not in every case, but in some cases. And we haven't surveyed this enough, but we know it can be present in meat. We know it can be present in milk. And some cities, their drinking water intake is just downstream of the effluent from one of these large industrial farms, so they're getting antibiotics in their water. What we can say is that there are probably millions of exposures every day in the United States of people to low levels of antibiotics, trace levels of antibiotics. What's the consequence? We don't know. Maybe there is no consequence. Maybe it's completely safe. Or maybe when you talk about it millions of times, that's what's contributing to so many of these rising diseases.
I think I saw in your book, Missing Microbes, that they had found resistant bacteria in about half the samples of meat that they tested.
It depends on the survey, but whether it's 20% or 80%, when you eat meat that you get at the supermarket, there's a reasonable chance that there is some trace level of antibiotic. And also the milk that our children drink. Kids who are drinking milk every day, there's a risk that they're getting antibiotics. Some parents say, my child has never had an antibiotic, but probably that's not true.
I noticed you were writing about neurons in our guts, and you said there's something like 100 million neurons. And these neurons signal to the brain all kinds of things related to hunger, mood, cognitive development. But they're signaling based on interaction with microbes. How is this affected by the antibiotic use?
I'll give you the bottom line first. We don't know. It's a wide open question. But as you say, there's an increasing body of evidence that the nature of the microbes in our gut, the composition of them, the genes that they carry, affect the signals, the neural signals going from our gut via a number of nerves right up to the brain. I mean, sometimes people say, I feel hungry in my gut. Somehow your brain has learned that. That's a very simple example. But there are increasing connections between the gut and the development of the brain in terms of thinking, of cognition. There's some work suggesting there's a relationship with mood. You know, the nervous system is a big chemical factory, and some of the chemicals that are coming in from below could definitely influence what's going on.
Well, let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Martin Blaser, and he is the author of Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Now, let's go back to the plagues. We've talked a lot about obesity. We talked a little bit about diabetes. We mentioned celiac disease. But there were several others that you had talked about in the book. One is the esophageal reflux, which causes heartburn. One is asthma. One is eczema. How many of these so-called modern plagues do you think are related to the overuse of antibiotics?
You mentioned esophageal reflux, asthma, and eczema. And these have been related to an organism that lives in the stomach called Helicobacter pylori. It's an organism I've been studying for about 30 years. And Helicobacter was discovered in the 1980s to be a major cause of stomach ulcers. In fact, the people who discovered it won the Nobel Prize. And later, we and others discovered that this bacteria had a major role in stomach cancer. So everything was indicating that this was a very bad organism. But the more we studied it, the more we realized that this organism is quite ancient, that people have had it in their stomach since time immemorial. But as a result of modern life, this bacterium is disappearing. And this is one of the places that I got the idea about four missing microbes, that some of our ancient organisms that are longtime residents, our friends, are disappearing. Well, Helicobacter is not just a friend because it can cause ulcers and it can cause cancer, but there now is a wide body of research suggesting that Helicobacter also protects the esophagus, protecting against high acid and reflux, and that people who don't have Helicobacter are at much higher risk for getting reflux esophagitis, and occasionally they can get a condition called Barrett's esophagus, and occasionally they can get esophageal cancer as well. So as Helicobacter is disappearing, gastric cancer is disappearing, but esophageal cancer is rising, and asthma is rising, and eczema is rising, and we have found evidence linking the lack of Helicobacter to these diseases, as if Helicobacter pylori was protective against getting these diseases, and now we've lost it.
In essence, if we were going to then turn to solutions, would you say that besides the reduction in use of the antibiotics, do you think that the germophobia is a little bit too extreme? We thought that we had to be more sanitary in order to protect life. Now, are we too sanitary?
I think you hit the nail on the head with the term you used, germophobia. Because there are some very bad germs, like the germ that causes tuberculosis or the virus that causes HIV, etc., because there are very bad germs, we have focused on those, forgetting for the moment that the world is full of germs. We live in a world of bacteria. Most of them are neutral to us, and many of them are good for us. They're beneficial to us, like many of the organisms in our own body. And so, to me, the fear is that by using these antibacterial substances, we use these soaps, they're in certain foods, etc., that we're causing collateral damage to our good guys, the good bacteria. And ultimately, when we have people washing their hands tens of millions of times a day across the United States with these antibacterial soaps, I don't know whether we're doing more good or more harm. It just hasn't been determined. But on a positive note, I think positive, the state of Minnesota banned the use of antibacterial soaps. They said there's no reason to use it. It's no better than soap and water. And I applaud that because I'm concerned that those antibiotic soaps are wounding our microbiome, our ancient composition. It's not like it's wounding us, but we're getting a lot of benefit from it. It's not clear that we're getting any benefit from it. And so there's only a biological cost.
In terms of other potential policies, solutions, it sounds like you also think this overuse of antibiotic on the farms is a big problem.
Yes, it is a big problem because it's spilling over into humans, the antibiotic residues in food. And also it's a problem because of resistant organisms. When antibiotics are used on the farm, It selects for bacteria that are resistant to their action, and sometimes these bacteria come over to humans. There have been many examples with Salmonella and Campylobacter, two important disease-causing organisms. The use on the farm has made some of these strains antibiotic resistant, and now when people are getting the infections from eating the foods of animal origin, they're getting infected with antibiotic resistant organisms. So this actually has been well known for a number of years, and the Food and Drug Administration is taking some early steps to ban the use of antibiotics on the farm. I would call it baby steps. And our free and aroused citizenry has to push the policymakers to actually do the right thing, to get these antibiotics out of the farm. In Europe, they banned it about 10 years ago.
Martin Blaser, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
It's really my pleasure to talk to you.
The book, again, is called Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. When we come back, we speak with renowned climate scientist Michael Mann. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest is a renowned climate scientist who can tell us both about the science and the policies. He's also lived the rough and tumble life of politics and wrote about it in his new book, The Madhouse Effect. Dr. Michael Mann hasn't lost hope that we can still address climate change before it's too late, though he acknowledges that the changes have already begun. Professor Michael Mann is a climatologist and geophysicist, and he's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University. Dr. Mann was one of the lead authors of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and has written a book called The Madhouse Effect. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle, Dr. Michael Mann. It's great to have you back here with us again.
Thanks. It's great to be back with you.
You have this new book to address the general public, but you have also done a lot of the climate science yourself. I wanted to talk first about this address that you gave recently. You had said that the tools that you and other climate scientists had developed are increasingly unnecessary, maybe because we can actually see the real effects of climate change now. There are two big questions that come out of that. First of all, how would you describe the effects that we can actually see right now?
So that was a comment I made actually at a hearing of the Democratic National Committee related to the Democratic platform. And I had been asked to talk to the committee about the science of climate change. And the point I was making was sort of, it was really almost a rhetorical point, and unfortunately, there's some of my detractors really went out of their way to take it out of context to make it sound like I was saying that we no longer need data and models to do science, and that's not at all what I was saying. What I was saying was when it comes to actually seeing the impacts of climate change, the impacts are no longer subtle, and it's no longer necessary to try to tease the signal out of the noise of natural climate variability in the way we would have had to do in the past, because the signal has become so large that we can actually see it with our very own two eyes. And the most recent example being the flooding in Louisiana. That was a record flooding event. And we know that the fact that there was so much rainfall was tied to the fact that there was a very large amount of moisture in the atmosphere. And that was tied to the very warm ocean temperatures, the Gulf of Mexico sea surface temperatures, as high as they've ever been. The last year, of course, has been a record year where the oceans have been warmer than they've ever been before. And so what that means is that warmer oceans evaporate more moisture into the atmosphere. There's more moisture available to turn into record rainfall events. And so the fact that we've seen, I think, a half dozen 1,000-year rainfall events. And what do we mean? When we say a 1,000-year rainfall event, we mean, based on the normal statistics of weather, that event shouldn't happen more often than once in a 1,000 years. And just over the last year, we probably had about a half dozen of those 1,000-year rainfall events, not just Louisiana, but Texas, in Arizona, in South Carolina, in West Virginia. And so what we're seeing in these very large increase in the number of extreme weather events, we're seeing the loading of the weather dice. We're seeing the sort of random dice of weather have been loaded by climate change towards these more extreme events. And, you know, that flooding is just part of it. We've seen record wildfires and unprecedented drought in California. We are seeing the impacts of climate change play out now in real time.
As I had understood this just from reading the layperson literature, is that you can't really identify one or two of these events and say, well, this is definitely a result of climate change, but collectively they are related to climate change.
It's somewhere in between the two statements, really. That's partly true, but it's not the whole story. And in fact, in our new book, in The Madhouse Effect, Tom Tolles and I include a cartoon that actually deals with this question of, you know, whether you can or not you can blame extreme weather events on climate change. And there's a little footnote in the cartoon, as there always are in Tom's cartoons. Many of your listeners will be familiar with his cartoons on the pages of the Washington Post, the square cartoons. And there's a little guy down in the corner, which is actually Tom himself, who's usually saying something pithy, something you want to read, the small print. And the small print of that one, it's a loophole you could lose a planet through. And what we mean there is, it's sort of a loophole to be able to say, well, you know, you can never blame any one weather event on climate change. It's tantamount to saying you can never blame any one death from lung cancer on smoking of cigarettes. Even though we know many people died from lung cancer because they smoked cigarettes. It could have happened naturally. So if you're talking about any one individual, there's always the possibility that it could have happened naturally. And in fact, that gave rise to a concept called fractional attribution, which is now used in climate change as well. It was used in the legal settlements with the tobacco industry that, you know, basically that some percentage of people who died of from lung cancer we know was caused by your product, and you have a liability that's associated with that. So even though it's a statistical connection, real people, actual people did die from lung cancer caused by smoking cigarettes, and actual weather events have been made worse in many different ways by the effects of climate change. And so when somebody says something like, well, you can't prove it was caused by climate change, it really is. It's a technicality. It's also like, I always like to use sports analogies in professional baseball. Barry Bonds, of course, broke the record for home runs, I think, one season, and then it was found that he had been taking steroids and that the record was invalidated. And, you know, his defense might be, for any one home run that I hit that season, you can't prove that that home run was caused by the steroid use. And that may be technically true, but it's still a loophole. And so that's sort of the analogy.
One of the things that seemed interesting to me over all of this is that the changes seem to have happened much faster than we were originally thinking they would happen. Is that true?
In many respects, it is true. And it really gets at a very important point. You know, the critics, those who favor an agenda of inaction, of not doing anything about the problem, will say, well, there's uncertainty in the science. And as long as there's uncertainty, we don't know for sure that, you know, the burning of fossil fuels is a problem, so we shouldn't take action. Well, that's not true. But even the very premise behind that sort of reasoning is wrong, because uncertainty cuts both ways. And yeah, maybe you can get lucky, and the uncertainties might cut in the direction of some of the impacts not being as bad as we predicted. But the history of the science seems to suggest the other possibility. in many respects, the changes have taken place faster than we predicted. The uncertainty appears to be cutting against us, not in our favor when it comes to the impacts of climate change. And that's true with the loss of Arctic sea ice. We're losing Arctic sea ice. The Arctic is sort of our refrigerator, and as we lose that sea ice, that impacts the entire planet in an adverse way. And the models have tended to predict that we shouldn't see the disappearance of sea ice in the late summer. We just, by the way, tied the second lowest sea ice level at the end of this summer. And so we're near record lows, and we're already well outside of the range of what the models predicted. The models predicted we shouldn't see a total disappearance of Arctic sea ice until the end of this century. If you extrapolate the trajectory we're on, scientists expect that within maybe a decade or two, we will see ice-free conditions in the Arctic. We also know that the ice sheets, the continental ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet, the West Antarctic ice sheet, losing ice well ahead of schedule. The models predicted that they shouldn't start, those ice sheets shouldn't start to disintegrate until the middle of this century. And in part, that's because some of the models actually have more snow accumulation taking place in the center of the ice sheet, where the atmosphere is actually slightly warmer. There's more moisture, so you get more snowfall in the interior of the ice sheet, and that offsets the melting that's taking place at the periphery of the ice sheet, where it meets the ocean, for example. Well, it turns out that that's not what's happening. We are losing ice at the periphery much faster than there's any replacement in the center of the ice sheets. And so we're losing ice from the continental ice sheets decades ahead of schedule. That means that we are seeing an increase in sea level rise from the melting of that ice that, again, is well ahead of schedule. So the sea level rise problem is worse than we expected based on the predictions that were made, you know, just a decade ago. And there are many other examples where the changes and the impacts are playing out faster and worse than what we had predicted.
And I imagine that the ecosystems themselves, both in the oceans and of land, are the most severely affected, which then has the ongoing influence on our food and water and that sort of a thing. Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of what we've seen so far?
That's absolutely right. And one of the problems is that when you start looking at impacts on, you know, ecosystems, on species, on food webs, there's something, you know, a term we use in science, nonlinear. It means that there are very complex interactions between, you know, living things and each other and their environment. And there's the potential that a small change in the external conditions can lead to a very large change in the behavior of that system. Tipping points, collapse. You can have the collapse of ecosystems where a small change in climate upsets the balance such that you really get a far more abrupt and profound impact on the environment, on species, animal species. Coral reefs is a very good example. They are under threat right now from multiple insults caused by human activity, climate change being one of them, warming of oceans, coral bleaching imperils coral reefs. But the increasing CO2 in the atmosphere is making the oceans more acid, and that's literally starting to dissolve the coral reefs. And then you add the pollutions, the pollutants that make it out into our oceans, and they're being hit by all these simultaneous insults. And again, it's the so-called nonlinearity. When you have a system, when you have a living thing, and we know this in our own lives, you know, when one bad thing happens to you, you can deal with it. When a couple of bad things happen to you, you know, it's a little hard to deal with. When three or four different things start going badly in your life, all of a sudden you feel like your entire world is collapsing. And that's because we react poorly, and all living things react poorly to multiple simultaneous insults. And that's what we're doing to our ecosystems right now. And it's a cause for worry. We are subjecting them to changes that they have not experienced in the entire history of their existence. And we're doing that in multiple ways. We're hitting them with multiple insults.
One of the things that you addressed in this new book of yours is your detractors, as you called them here. And they had been very vocal historically with the denial and the argument that there wasn't enough certainty in the science to move policy forward. It seems like, though, they have been quieter lately. Would you say that's true, or is that just perception because of the media I follow?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting insight, and I think that is true to some extent. I think that climate change denialism is becoming somewhat marginalized, at least in our mainstream public discourse. Now, there's some important provisos there. For example, one of the two candidates for president is a climate change denier. And so, you know, climate change denial is still expressed at the very highest levels of our politics right now. But I do think that climate change denial is less welcome in polite conversation now. And I think that's in part due to, you know, something that we started out talking about at the beginning of this interview. People can see that something's happening. It's no longer subtle. The impacts of climate change are no longer subtle. When people can start to see that something happening with their own two eyes, it makes it very difficult for you to tell them that it's not happening. And I think that's really one of the critical developments here, that the profound nature of the impacts of climate change is such that it just makes it not credible anymore to deny that something is happening.
So in the book, in this new book of yours, you said that we can still avoid the catastrophes, maybe even reverse some of it. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. You know, the reality is that there is no one threshold. I can't give you a precise amount of warming of the globe and promise you that if we keep warming below that, bad things won't happen. Let's, you know, face it. There are some bad things that we already see happening just from the climate change that's already taken place. So it's a matter of how far we're willing to go down this dangerous road. And, you know, the experts who have looked at the impacts of climate change have determined that once you go beyond about 2 degrees Celsius warming of the planet relative to the pre-industrial time, that's 3.5 Fahrenheit warming, and we're already about halfway there. We've already warmed the planet a degree Celsius. We maybe have another half a degree Celsius in the pipeline. And so we only have a small amount of wiggle room if we're going to avoid crossing that dangerous 2 degree Celsius limit. We can still do it. If you just look at the numbers, if you crunch the math, it is possible for us to bring our emissions down at a rate of several percent a year in the decades ahead, such that we avoid crossing that sort of 2 degree Celsius warming range where we really do start to see the worst impacts of climate change. So if we act now, we can avert a catastrophe, and we are seeing some progress already due to the amazing sort of developments in renewable energy technology, the dramatic increases in the market share of renewable energy, and even here in the U.S., where we have seen a dramatic increase in wind and solar power, in electric vehicles. We're starting to turn the corner. Last year, the numbers came in and told us that carbon emissions, for the first time on record globally, actually went down. And that's a direct response to the efforts, you know, among many of the nations of the world to try to stem the tide and do something about the problem and transition towards renewable energy. So we're starting to turn the corner. The problem is we need to turn the corner even faster if we are going to avoid crossing that dangerous threshold of warming. And so we got an important start in the process in Paris last December, where nearly 200 nations around the world, including the world's top emitters of carbon, agreed to make substantial reductions, enough to cut the warming roughly in half from where we would be going under business as usual emissions, basically getting us halfway to what we need to do to keep the warming below 2 degrees Celsius. So we're starting to go down the right path, but we're going to have to do a lot more if we're going to avert catastrophic impacts on our planet.
Is there any way for you to be able to explain, like in specific terms, like how much would we need to do, change our energy by X percent, or change our driving habits by Y percent, or anything like that, or our eating habits?
Yeah, so I mean, there are a lot of things that we can do on a voluntary basis that cut our carbon emissions, decreases our personal carbon footprint, and we ought to be doing them anyways, because what we call no regrets actions, like bicycling to work when we can rather than driving to work, well, it saves us money, it makes us healthier, more efficient appliances saves us money as well. There are all these things that we can do that cut our carbon emissions and make us healthier and happier and save us money, and we ought to be doing those things anyways. In fact, we call them negative costs, because actually there's a benefit immediately to doing it. But that doesn't get us as far. Voluntary actions alone don't get us as far as we need to go if we are going to avoid that dangerous level of warming. And so if you talk to economists, they'll tell you that to really solve this problem, we need to put a price on carbon. What that means is when you burn carbon, producers of fossil fuel energy and power have to pay for the damage that their product is doing to our planet through some sort of mechanism. It can be a tax, a carbon tax. It could be some sort of cap and trade system. But one way or another, we need to put a cost on the burning of fossil fuels so we level the energy marketplace, so that renewable energy, which isn't degrading our planet in the same way, can compete fairly against fossil fuel energy, which has this cost that isn't currently represented in the marketplace. There isn't a price signal right now for the damage that fossil fuel energy is doing to the planet. And until you put a price on the burning of carbon, you really don't have the incentive system necessary to steer us in the direction we need to go. So, many of the experts, economists who have studied this problem, will tell you we need a price on carbon. And if we get a price on carbon, that actually will lead us. It's almost like it's magic. Once you cost the damage through, a mechanism like a carbon tax, then people start changing their behavior in the direction that we need to change our behavior, because it's built into the market.
What I was getting at was getting a sense of how much we need to alter either the energy use or the, I know farming is also another big source of emissions. And so I guess I was trying to get a sense of how much we would need to shift in order to avert going down a disastrous path.
We have to bring our carbon emissions down by about 5% a year over the next several decades if we're going to avoid raising CO2 levels to where we get that 2 degrees Celsius or more warming of the planet. And so we obviously need policies that achieve those sorts of reductions. Now, some of those policy changes are almost invisible to us. If you have a carbon tax, like I said, then all of a sudden, energy producers will increase the percentage of their portfolio that is from renewable sources, from wind, from solar, from geothermal. So, the energy that you're getting comes increasingly from renewable sources. And so we might end up paying a little bit more for energy as we go through that transition. But it really is almost imperceptible, the impact that it actually has on our lives. So some people think that we have to fundamentally change our lifestyles to deal with this problem. That isn't necessarily true. We have existing technology right now that if we scale it up at the rate that we could potentially scale it up, and there are peer-reviewed scientific studies that show this, that we could meet nearly 100% of our projected energy needs from renewable energy, from renewable sources alone, within a matter of a couple of decades. We can do that. We have the technology to do it. We just need the policy incentives to move us in that direction. And to us, in the way that we lead our daily lives, It doesn't necessarily need to lead to any dramatic change in our lifestyles. That having been said, sure, there are things that we can do, changes in our lifestyle, that if we make them voluntarily, they definitely will help out the problem. But no, we do not have to dramatically change our lifestyles to solve this problem. We just need to favor policies that will incentivize the market to move in the direction that it needs to go for us to basically wean ourselves off fossil fuels.
I think you said 5% change is what we would actually need in terms of emissions?
5% reduction a year in the carbon emissions.
Okay.
And right now, I mean, renewable energy is almost growing at a rate that will achieve that as long as we incentivize those renewable energy sources.
So the solar and the wind are growing at a rate that can almost get us there. And so you're thinking perhaps we can meet that 5% by just a little bit of tweaking.
Yeah, let me give you an example. So we sometimes talk about market parity or grid parity. When renewable energy becomes as or less expensive than fossil fuel energy. And right now we're on a trajectory where that will be true probably in a matter of 5 to 10 years. If we did nothing other than just let, you know, the renewable energy providers do what they're doing, we soon enough would be at the point where it would be cheaper to go with renewable energy anyways. Now, the problem is that we don't have 5 to 10 years to wait if we're going to decrease our carbon emissions so that we avoid warming the planet more than 2 degrees Celsius, and that means that you do need extra market incentives that help steer us in the direction that we're starting to go anyway. So it's sort of like you're just sort of accelerating the natural process that's already underway, where we are moving away from fossil fuel energy towards renewable energy. In a matter of years, renewable energy will outcompete fossil fuel energy even without a price on carbon. But we need a price on carbon to get us there even sooner.
When these policy discussions occur, do you still have a sense that the fossil fuel industry are fighting on the other side to prevent the renewable energies from coming online in such a powerful way? Or do you have a sense that they're going to perhaps maybe even buy into the renewable energies in order to stay viable companies?
Yeah, I think the enlightened companies, and we're already seeing that, are going to invest a larger and larger amount of their portfolio in renewable sources. I mean, that is the direction that the global economy is going. China recognizes that. They are outspending us. They are investing far more in renewable energy. They're moving towards, in fact, they have invested so much in solar cell technology that their products have flooded the global market and led to a sharp decrease in the cost of solar panels. So the research and development that they've done has benefited the entire world with cheaper solar panels. So that's the direction that the global economy is headed. And those countries that get on board are going to be out ahead on this. And those countries that continue to rely on fossil fuels for energy are going to fall behind the rest of the world in terms of their global competitiveness. And so, you know, that is the direction that things are going anyways. And if we, you know, don't move in that direction, then we fall behind the rest of the world.
And I can't let you leave our radio program without explaining the hockey stick.
Sure thing. So back in the late 1990s, my co-authors and I engaged in a scientific analysis where we attempted to extend the record of global temperatures back in time, because we only have about a century and a half of widespread thermometer measurements around the globe, and that allows us to construct a curve that shows how temperatures have changed over the last 150 years. And that curve shows that the globe has warmed and it continues to warm. In fact, the last year was the warmest year on record. But what the instrumental data alone can't tell us is how unusual that sort of warming might be in a longer-term context. And so back in the late 1990s, to try to create that longer-term context, we did an analysis where we made use of what we call proxy data, like tree rings and corals and ice cores and sediments, to reconstruct how the climate had changed in the more distant past. And that led to a curve that depicted our estimate of how temperatures had changed over the last 1,000 years. And that curve showed relatively modest changes from 1,000 years ago to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. In fact, a small drop in temperatures as we headed into what was known as the Little Ice Age of the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, followed by an unprecedented spike, which is the spike of modern global warming that takes us outside of the range of the variation that was evident as far back as we could go, 1,000 years. And it sort of looks like a hockey stick where the blade is the modern warming spike that indeed is unprecedented as far back as we or others have been able to take these sorts of estimates. Because of the appearance of the graph, it got called the hockey stick. It became an icon in the climate change debate, an iconic sort of entity in the climate change debate because it told a simple story. You didn't need to understand the complex workings of Earth's climate to understand what this curve was telling us, that there is this unprecedented warming of the planet that has taken place over the last century and a half. And by inference, it probably has to do with human activity. And in fact, we know that we cannot explain that warming without the effect of increasing greenhouse gas concentrations. So I think because it became a symbol, an easy to understand symbol that really conveyed in a very understandable way the profound nature of the changes that we are causing in the climate of our planet, it became a target for the critics, those who don't want to believe in the scientific evidence, fossil fuel interests and the various groups that they fund who have been doing their best to try to discredit the science of climate change because they don't want to see any regulation of carbon emissions. The hockey stick curve became a focal point of their attacks and their critiques. And I found myself as a young scientist who never had any interest in being in the fray on the larger contentious political issue of climate change and what to do about it, I found myself at the center of that debate. And ultimately, I chose to embrace the opportunity that provided me to inform the dialogue about this very important problem. But it isn't what I signed up for when I first started out in science.
And some of this is discussed in your new book, The Madhouse Effect, where you talk about how all of the detractors used the ideas about science and trying to falsify science, but using it to try to deny what the facts were telling us. The peer review process, as you and I both know, isn't perfect, right? But what the denialists say when they are talking about the peer review process, they argue that there was sort of a groupthink thing going on. What do you say about something like that?
I'll quote one of the great science communicators of our day, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who has put it very bluntly. The great thing about science is it's true whether or not you believe it. And there are many who just don't want to believe what the science has to say. But what's so important about science, and Carl Sagan, perhaps the greatest science communicator in my lifetime anyways, talked about how science has this very important self-correcting process. If you're wrong, you will be found out. You will be shown to be wrong because there's too much of an incentive for other scientists to prove you wrong. The more extraordinary the claim you make, the more other scientists will be going after you because if they can be the one to take down this very famous study, then that brings them much prominence as well. And so there's a real incentive for other scientists to try to disprove each other. That's the way you get ahead in science, is by not by just saying what we already know is correct. The way you get ahead in science, the way you get articles in journals like Nature and Science, is by providing us something new, showing us something different, proving that something that we thought was right is wrong. That's really where the incentive is. So the incentive in science is to be skeptical. And unfortunately, you have some individuals, and we do lampoon this in the book with I won't give away the joke here, but basically it's about Galileo and how climate change deniers like to compare themselves to Galileo. Well, simply rejecting mainstream science doesn't make you a Galileo. It makes you a crank dressed up, dressing up like Galileo. Somebody wants to think of themselves as that. But real scientists are skeptics. All good scientists are skeptics. And we hold each other accountable for providing compelling evidence. And if a study is wrong, if it comes to the wrong conclusion, then the process of science will establish that it's wrong. That's the self-correcting machinery that comes through peer review, as you describe it, where scientists publish their results and other scientists can go after them. And eventually that leads to, you know, assessments where there is widespread consensus because there are multiple lines of evidence from different directions that all lead to the same conclusion. When you reach that point, whether it's gravity, the theory of gravity, or climate change, human-caused climate change, when you reach that point where there are multiple lines of evidence from many different teams of scientists all pointing in the same direction, that's when you have a robust scientific understanding. And again, you know, with climate change, there's about as widespread a consensus based on many different lines of evidence from many, many thousands of different groups of scientists, about as strong evidence for human-caused climate change as there is for the theory of gravity.
Well, thank you so much for being with us again. Dr. Michael Mann, it's great to have you back with us.
It's always great to be with you. Thank you.
Professor Michael Mann is a climatologist and geophysicist, and he's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University. Dr. Mann was one of the lead authors of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and has written a book called The Madhouse Effect. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.